From a competition to a pleasure hunt and all the stops in between, we cover it all here at Coon Hunting Media.
Houndsman Advantage is a proud sponsor of the Coon Hunting Media Podcast. Houndsman Advantage is the premier digital scoring solution for the competition hunter. The app gives the necessary tools to score in competition or track your dog's hunting performance while on pleasure hunts. Imagine the benefit of having this tool at your fingertips on every hunt. Some of the features included within the app are a scorecard view, a summary view with tree timers for up to four dogs. There is no more calculating split strike and tree points manually. They are preloaded within the app. Cumulative scores will be automatically totaled with current plus, minus, circle, or deleted points after each scoring situation. The app includes the full rules for UKC, PKC, Pro Sport, and AKC. A search function is included, which allows you to find specific rules instantly. The app allows you to scratch or withdraw a dog at any time during the cast. When the app is running under the UKC rules, it will automatically scratch a dog that has reached the scratchable amount of minus points. The app includes a kennel function for personal information such as registration numbers and entry cards. You can also store analytics on your dog's accuracy, win percentages, and much, much more. Even though the app has been tailored with the competition hunter in mind, the pleasure hunter has not been left out. You can set up pleasure hunts that track up to two dogs' performance at a time. You can keep totals on accuracy, whether good or bad. This will be broken down to the game scene, dens, slicks, and so on. When you register on the app, you are given a one-week free trial. Within the app, navigate to the news and update section. There, you will find a video that will walk you through how to use the entire app. Don't lose a cast because you didn't know the score or you had the wrong score. Give yourself the advantage, the Houndsman advantage. The app is available for download at the App Store and Google Play.
Welcome to another edition of the Coon Hunting Media Podcast. We got Jason, Kyle, Johnny. We got a special guest with us, Dan Sheridan from Illinois, here with us tonight.
Returning guest.
Yeah, returning guest.
Returning guest.
Actually, one of the gang. We start bringing him in on some of the stuff we talk every day anyway.
Yeah, pretty much.
New team member.
Pretty regular.
How are you, Dan?
I'm doing good. Sitting here trying to figure out how to get a hound in the woods without getting his feet cut up on this snow.
How cold is it up there today?
Today it warmed up. We got up 36, 37 degrees there for a little bit, and it slushed up, and I thought, boy, them coon will get down and walk tonight. And by the time I got doing some things that I needed to do here this evening and went out a while ago, and it's got back down to 32, and that snow's crushed them back up, and they're calling for 40 degrees tomorrow and a low of about 34, 35 tomorrow night, and that will be probably in them dark hours just before dawn, you know, for that coldest temperature. I'm thinking I can probably hunt a dog tomorrow night on the slush maybe and not get his feet cut up. I mean, you take the pads off of one, you know how it is trying to get him back on all 4 feet again.
Mm-hmm. And buy him a pair of Air Jordans to wear.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You've actually had below zero temps up there though, haven't you guys?
Yesterday morning, just before daylight there, about between 6:30 and 7:00, up here on the prairie, the neighbor up here has got one of those electronic weather stations, and up here on this prairie, it's open prairie up there. It sets out in the field across the road from his house, and there was about 30-minute stretch there. It hit 8 below yesterday morning. So yeah, we've been down pretty cold.
I want no part of that. I know Sunday we were at Mom and Dad's eating dinner or eating lunch after church, and I was looking through Facebook and I saw some of those videos that John Steber was posting the other night, and I was like, Lord have mercy. I would not be coon hunting up there in that right now. It's just too cold. That just looked cold watching them.
Yes, it is. It is. And the only thing is the snow, you know. And I've treed coon plumb up to zero. I don't know that I ever treed one on the outside with it below zero.
That's because they're smarter than us. They go inside.
Yes, yes.
They, Kyle will get out there in it, but not us.
I know. And the snow's got crusted enough. With the sun shining on it, it'll even though it's below freezing. Like yesterday, I'm trying to remember. I think it stayed down in the teens all day. But yet that snow shining on it, that sun shining on that snow, the sun's getting far enough north again. Now it's got enough energy. It'll kind of liquefy it on top, and then when it, you know, when the sun goes off of it, boy, it sets up hard. So you're not seeing the coon tracks so much. They're walking on top of it right now. Mm-hmm. But I had seen a couple out in the evening before dark, getting down trying to find something to pick on, you know. So they are down moving some, but as I get older, I don't like to get out there in it like I used to. I mean, you know, there was years gone by that I would try. I'd try five or six nights a week, you know, and you're lucky to get one treed on the outside, but I was trying anyway. I spent a lot of years there that I hunted just about every night. So,
mm-hmm.
And like you said, John Stieber, I think John still hunts just about every night. You know,
he's tough.
He's dedicated.
He's like Kyle here. Kyle's an every nighter, and it's like, boys, I'm not doing it. So, hey, the bright side is spring is coming.
Spring is coming. And it's right around the corner.
You think about it. January is well over half gone, and we're going to blink our eyes. It's going to be February, and we're going to be looking at March going to be here. I mean, it's not.
Lord.
I know. Because I went out from work the other evening, and it was still daylight, and I'm like, oh, that's a good sign.
Yeah.
Well, that's supposed to – well, I make you feel real good, Dan. It's supposed to be like 55 to here tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Thank you for letting me know. It takes me too long to get there. I'd just run on down and visit you.
Well, if you do, get you a stop by budget and rent you a van.
Yeah.
And pack you up about 50 coon, bring with you. That way we'll have a few, and we'll hunt in good weather and have plenty of coons.
Yep.
Yes, yes. You know, this time of year, you can catch a lot of them around old barn, around old house, you know, in live trap if you're wanting to get one like that, you know. But no, I'm just not as likely to get out in it like I did when I was younger.
I can't blame you at all. So
now my old bones is aching a little worse when it gets cold. The older I get, the worse I hate the hottest weather and the coldest weather. So
mm-hmm, exactly.
I'm kind of a spring and fall kind of guy. But
yes, sir.
No, and got this dog up here, and I'd like to have him ready next weekend over here at Robinson at the home club. We've got a little double header on Saturday night. I'd like to have him ready, but he's probably about as good as he's going to get right now, you know.
Might be lucky to get out one time between now and then with the weather.
Tomorrow night, and when I got to look at that crusted snow and feeling it under my feet, I thought, you know, if I'm going to get one night in here, because it's supposed to hit, I think it was 40 tomorrow, and stay above freezing then tomorrow night. It was going right back down. It's headed right back down. It's not going to stay here long.
No, it's not.
And I thought, I'm going to get one good night here. I want to make the best of it. And if I'm going to have a good night tomorrow night, I just looking at the weather here, 40 tomorrow and 34 tomorrow night. And then Saturday, supposed to get a high of 31. So what that tells me is that by midnight tomorrow night, it's going to be dipping down there, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I got to get that hunt in before, if I'm going to do it off of the frozen snow, I need to get that hunt in, you know,
early
tomorrow evening.
Yep.
And if I'm going to get one good night, I'd rather it be tomorrow night than tonight. So
mm-hmm.
That's why I'm not in the woods tonight. But then the next time we go above freezing, then looks like will be Thursday of next week. But we are when it hits 40 tomorrow, it will knock a lot of it off. You
it
know,
will. It will.
And it's just to the point now, and unless you've been around it and hunted on it, man, I remember one year them dogs got deep and I was way away from the truck and I like had to pack two of them back. I had three head that night, I think, back when I was young and didn't care to handle multiple dogs. And then two, you could track them the whole way back the truck. And I thought I was going to have to carry them. They just got where they didn't even want to walk, you know.
Yeah, cut them up so bad. Yep.
Mm-hmm. You just cut them up so bad. It was a bad situation. But
like I said, spring's coming. We just got to deal with it a little bit longer. So
it's right around the corner.
What I was going to do, Dan, is kind of tell our listeners, this is kind of our game plan for tonight. So we've been talking amongst ourselves. You've been on those conversations. Like I said, we all talk pretty regularly, but we wanted to make sure we got kind of back with the year rolling. We want to get into some more of these interviews with different hound breeders and so forth. So we've got quite a few things we're trying to get lined up or in the works right now. And Kyle and Johnny and I got to talking around there some today, and we was like, we need to get another one done ourselves beforehand. We've got several interviews lined up at the Winter Classic, and we thought, let's get Dan on the phone and let because you've been around the game for a long time, and the listeners will get to hear some of that here in a few minutes. But you've been around the game for a long time. We were thinking, let's let you go in and tell us about kind of what the hunts were like when you first started. So, and you can kind of give a time frame on that. And then what we were thinking was, you've guided and you've guided a lot of big casts. You've hunted a lot of dogs over the years for people. You've drew out against a lot of the big names. We were thinking, if we were sitting around here looking through pedigrees, and it don't have to be a blue tick, any different breed or whatever, and we're looking at, and we're talking about some of these dogs that have done big things over the years and stuff, you've probably been in the woods with quite a few of those. So we were thinking letting you go through and tell us about some of those hunts, some of those dogs you remember and some of the reasons they stand out and things. So that's kind of what we wanted to do tonight. And we'll kind of let you take over from there. We'll ask some questions if we can think of it, but just to let you tell us a little bit about some of it.
Well, if I go back, guys, I think Kyle and I touched that on that first podcast I done with you when he was up at that time. But I was born in 1960, in June of 1960. And by the time I was probably five, I started going to the woods some with my older brother. I had a brother 7 years older than me, and he was a hard hunter, real hard hunter. He hunted some dogs for some older gentlemen. And we always had some dogs growing up. Dad's dad, as I said in the first podcast, was a coon hunter's coon hunter. It wasn't just about the fur. It was about that dog and that dog work. And, I mean, he was a staunch believer in having a dog that could run a track and could cold trail and excel at it. You know, he was by heart a blue tick man, but I remember a lot of stories that he had a pair of walker dogs, you know. And the old timers wanted to come from miles around to see that pair of walker dogs that could tree a coon, because everybody, when they thought of a walker, was thinking of a foxhound, you know. And I remember seeing pictures of them, and Lord, I don't know what year it had been, and I think it was 1944 that the walkers split off out of the English and started taking the ticks off of them. And then, of course, the blue ticks split off in 1946. And it happened, that all started right down here at Greenville, Illinois, just down Interstate 70 here from me. And, so I go back a ways, but as I think about it, I remember the first night I went to the woods hunting, I could walk you to that big old oak, still big old oak tree today. And the corn was in roasting ears, it's down in the river bottom, and they cut dogs in that cornfield, and they run a little bit, and they come out of that cornfield and treed, and right on the corner of a little woods right there. And it was a farm lane that went back to that little woods. We was able to drive back there close, and I remember as a little kid walked out there. I don't know, might have still had some carbide lights among us. There was four or five of us along that night, and somebody had been the designated guy to stay at the car with the little kid when they hauled him along, because he'd been whining, wanting to go forever, you know. But they walked me out on the edge of that cornfield there, and somebody or maybe a couple of them. And that, in them days, about the only good shining light we had was them old 5 or 6 or 8 or 10 cell flashlights. You know, the big long silver screw together.
Mm-hmm.
And you could add more sections to them to give you more battery power, you know, so you had a brighter light. But anyway, they're shining up in there, and it looked like a Christmas tree, guys. There was probably a sow and a sow and litter down low, and there was a sow and litter up high. And I mean, it just looked, they'd all took refuge in that one big oak tree. So somewhere along in there in 65, 66 is the first time I remember going to woods. And it wasn't long after that, you know, that they got figured out I was getting where I could keep up, and my brother started taking me a lot more. And I remember some of the first hunts we went to, guys, over there south of Newton. It's the first one I remember. And I don't know how it was down there up in this country, you know, a little old school, little old country school, they'd quit using it or something, and that building became available, and or a little old church that the congregation had died off and died down, and it had become vacant, you know, and it was over there south of Newton, a little old church house or little old schoolhouse out in the country on a crossroads. It still had some parking room out in front of it, you know, and I remember going to that hunt, and that would have been probably, and Dad went along so that somebody'd be at the car if I got tarred and, you know, I remember my brother entering that hunt, but I don't remember now what dog he entered. But in those days, guys, there was way, way, way more grade dogs than what there were registered dogs. You know,
mm-hmm.
A lot of families had a hound back there, or two or three hounds back in those days, but very few people had papered dogs. So, you know, I can remember even at Robinson,
we've kind of come full circle on that now. Everybody, lots of people are doing that, wanting to do that again, come back in. That's where the X-breeds have come back into. People started realizing them crosses like that worked real good, and that's you starting to see it as a very common breeding practice again.
And having showed hogs some over the years when the kid was in 4-H and everything, it's pretty hard to beat a crossbreed with a purebred a lot of times, because that purebred, after so many, you know, so long, there's just something about it, you know, and I don't know if that would have something to do with it in the genes or what, but a lot of times within your breed, do you find what you want within your breed, you know? Wow.
Don't even start there, Dan, because I can done tell you and I could get started on this and go down a rabbit hole that we'd be talking for 3 hours. I'm right there with you on that, because my mind's always spinning
exactly.
on that.
Exactly. But I remember then up through the 60s into the 70s, then you seen that trend start to trend over where more people was packing that papered dog. A lot of them had yellow papers back at that point, you know. And they hadn't even thought about purple bred dogs at that point. And then along comes for long, you start seeing the purple bred, you know, the purple ribbon bred hounds, and everything started changing along that line.
Let me stop you again. You're a little bit of a generation ahead of us. So we're very familiar with it when we went purple ribbon bred. Tell us and the listeners that's I'll say younger. We're not younger. We're getting old, too. What was the yellow paper hounds? What was that?
That was dogs, and I don't remember what it was, how many generations had to be purebred to become purple ribbon bred.
So they were working. They were building up. That's what
they were building on that. And then UKC come out with the, you know, because that was the papers back in them days, mm-hmm. you know. And that was the United Kennel Club. They, the old Dr. Furnham, I think was his name, had been down here at Greenville with C.O. Smith and the Blue Tick people, Albert Vaughn, and some of them was there at that first meeting, you know, and said, okay, here's going to be our breed standards. We're going to start the Blue Tick breed, you know. And so it took several years to build onto the Purple Ribbon Bred Hound. A lot of people look at a set of papers and never even realize that there might have ever been anything different. Yeah. And I don't know what a set of crossbred papers looks like nowadays.
Yeah, and that's where I was heading with that. I mean, I knew the concept of it, but that's for us, we ignore the PR dogs. I mean, that's kind of, you know, that's just a dog to us. But back in the day when you're talking about when you started getting people that finally had that PR dog, that was a big accomplishment back then. They were breeding to breed it. They were making a breed.
Yes.
Exactly what they were doing.
They were building a breed, you know. The flop people, the blue tick people, the black and tan people. They'd said, okay, you know, here's where we go from here, and everybody was starting to develop their standards and everything up through the 50s into the 60s and so, but like I said, here in this area, through the 60s up into 70s, there was always way more grade dogs or unregistered dogs than what there was registered dogs that even had papers. You know, mm-hmm. there might be one cast of registered dogs compared to six or eight cast of grade, what they call a grade dog, you know? Right. And I mean, that dog, a Catria Coon, might look like a cur dog more than it did a hound sometimes, you know, maybe short eared and there was a lot of short tailed or bob tailed dogs, you know, that them old cur breeders have bred and that. And I remember one of our, I don't know if I've ever said it in your hearing, but I had my oldest sibling was my sister, and she loved coon hunting just as much or more than us boys did. And when she got married, her husband married her and two head of hounds. She had a grade hound and a registered hound. She had a red tick English dog, a direct son of Red Robin. And I think that Red Robin had won or made the final cast at least of the ACHA World Hunt back in those days. And then she had a little saddleback short tailed female. They were both nice hounds, but nobody had ever registered that little female. You know, whether she had been part black and tan, part cur, I don't know. I don't even remember where she'd got her. But there was one of them great dogs that in the early days would show up at a hunt, you know. And so that being said, now I've went off chasing down that rabbit hole, Jason. I forgot where I was at in my conversation. But then we've seen the evolution of it rolling over until more and more hounds had a pedigree. They were hunting registered dogs, and then the next thing, you know, boom, the grade part of a hunt went away. Mm-hmm. You didn't see it anymore. It had to be a registered dog to hunt in that hunt. So even up into the 80s, I was going down after 84. I met T.C. Jones the first time. He was up here at Princeton, Indiana, hunting in the UKC World. And he made that top 20 that year with Ranger and finished ninth, I believe it was. But I got to going down hunting with him, and I was down there one time, and I said, T, where can I find a good broke check dog? I was starting to reach out and kind of get away from the straight old Albert Vaughn dogs that I'd started with, and I didn't, you know, and I had my first training collar. And I was wondering sometimes if them dogs is right or not. I said, I need a check dog. And he said, I know where there's one at. And she was a blue tick. He went down there in the country and got her. And I forget, we made some kind of a deal. And I come home with that female. Well, I come home with a really nice little light-colored blue female. A lot of people wouldn't have liked her. She used a chop mouth on the ground. But she had yellow papers. Mm-hmm. Okay? So she was not purple ribbon bred. And back there, kind of like on Boyd's Little Joe and the English breed and some of them, you've seen that pedigree, and there was old Rock and Nell and Jim and Bonnet, and, you know, all there was no registration number or anything. It was dogs' names is all there was. And that's what the yellow papers or the non-purple ribbon papers were, you know. There wasn't a name and a number. And I forget how many generations back it was that she run off into dogs that did not have registration numbers. Mm-hmm. But she was a nice hound, was a good check dog. And she was one of them back in there when I was talking about hunting when it was so bad and hunting 7 nights a week. You know, you was always looking to keep food on your table and food for the hounds to eat. So you was out there trying to get a little fur money when season was in to do that with. And I hunted just about every night, you know, and I remember one night, I got back to the truck and man, I was frozen. I got back to the house and I had not treated coon on the outside that night. And she was one of them. I had two head of hounds that night. And when I got back to the truck, got to the house, it was 4 below when I got home that night, you know, mm-hmm. And she was one of them. But I thought about that, but back to the subject of the hunts and everything, there got to be getting more clubs would develop, you know, and you had more hunts. But even clear up into the 70s, into the 80s, there just was not the hunts that there is now, you know. And in the meantime, ACHA was coming up through the ranks, and they was the first one that really got out there and pushed a world championship. And something you got to remember is back in them days, it was pretty hard on man and beast because it was 3-hour casts. You know,
that's something we never experienced. That we grew up in the day of the 2-hour, but never hunted the 3-hour. That was before our time.
And a lot of times back in those days, guys, in that 3rd hour is when the coon dog really showed up. That dog early in the evening might look pretty good, but as them coons started laying up and them tracks started cooling off, you know. That old dog that was a steady old cooner was the one that usually showed up in that last hour, you know. And you seen it a lot. In fact, I, at that point, was hunting some blue dogs at Katrina layups. And when they went to 2 hours, I thought, man, you know how many casts I've won in that last hour with a couple of laid-up coon, you know. And I hated to see the 2-hour casts come. Now, at my age now, I don't mind the 1-hour cast. So, you know, and like I touched in the first podcast I done with Kyle, our hounds, guys, have evolved so much. You cannot believe what I've seen in my lifetime. You know, the evolution of the hound has just. The modern day hound, these hounds that travel like they do nowadays, you know, and somehow in the early days, the blue tick breed, which is our breed of choice, all of us that's here tonight talking, it's our breed of choice. But I remember those dogs that you searched and searched and searched and searched to find one that didn't just belly rub and waller. Mm-hmm. They would cold trail. Oh, he's got a cold nose. Yeah, but he didn't go anywhere with it. You know, and I mean, he ball going that way and ball coming back this way and it just was not moving. And when I was, when Kyle and Johnny was up, for the UKC zones down at Florida this year, you know, I mean, whether they realize it or not, when they let me see, what's her name? Rip's half sister, Snap.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
yeah,
Snap.
Yeah, they let me see her go for the first time. I put a watch on her when they cut her, you know. And Kyle had said she moved good. I put a watch on her, you know. And when she had located and come solid, I'm thinking, oh, that was nice. She run that nice little old track and jammed that tree up. She must be about halfway to the woods down that ditch right there because she's got that big carrying mouth, you know. And I said, how far is she, Kyle? And he showed me the Garmin. And she'd been on the ground 3 minutes and 20-some seconds, and she was 820 treed solid, you know. That's a blue tick. Now, I've seen Walker dogs over the years that hunted like that, but we've got that coming up in our breed, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it's what all the breeds are striving for.
Yeah.
The 1-hour cast makes that dog have to get it done quicker.
That's a good point. It does.
The 1-hour cast have evolved this whole thing further than what it was, you know. of finding that dog that covers ground, travels quick, decides what they're going to get hooked on quick, you know. And so the evolution of the dog from when I started as a kid, what I see nowadays is, I mean, it is so far gone from where it was 50 years ago, you know, 60 years ago, especially because most breeds had belly rubbers that would get down and just belly rub and grind on the ground. And I remember, my older brother that I spoke of just a little bit ago that started taking me to the hunts early and everything. I remember among us at our household, just about the time he got married and moved out, the first top fast ground covering, quick to get something done hound that we found, got him off a dog jockey somewhere. And he had a big problem for that day, and that's why nobody would keep him, and that's why he was at a dog jockey's. He was a blanket back Brindle plop dog that hunted like these modern dogs do, long before you ever thought about any kind of a tracking device.
Yeah, yeah, you couldn't hunted these dogs of today.
No,
back then you just
way.
Couldn't. You just couldn't have done it without the tracking devices.
No way.
Kyle has said that.
How many times, if you didn't have that Garmin in your hand, guys, nowadays, would you say, "Where's my dog at?"
I wouldn't go to the woods. And Kyle said that 100 times that the Garmin's revolutionized the coon hunting world, and it has.
They sure have. You know, and that dog. Let's say you'd be out there and it'd go to raining, and so you had some background noise and stuff. And night after night after night, we drove the roads trying to find that dog, you know, because he got out of pocket, what we call pocket nowadays. He got out of pocket. He was in the country somewhere. And a lot of times, if you drove close enough, you could hear him setting tree because he'd get treed and stay till he broke down. Mm-hmm. I don't know how many days he might stay on a tree. And countless times over the 4 or 5 years we hunted that dog, he would finally break down, leave that tree, and we'd look the next day. And, you know, back in them days, a lot of times, them old dogs, if you lost one, you left your hunting coat, you come back the next morning before you went to work, and there it was laying on that coat. Not this dog. He did not have a reverse, and he did not have a distance that he wouldn't cover to go get a coon treed, you know. And so if we'd had tracking systems back in them days, he was a top hound. He really was. He was straight. He wasn't junky. You didn't have to worry about him leaving out of there on something, you know. And as long as the conditions was right and it wasn't windy and it wasn't rainy or whatever, I mean, it was good. But he'd break down and come out to somebody's house. You'd be able to read a newspaper through him. He'd have his pads wore off his feet. And he was good for about a week or two, and then he'd start getting healed up and fed up, and then come the next night that he blew out on you again, you know, and so he'd play the same game.
Couldn't tell you what
his pedigree was, but to the point of trying to think back of some dogs that was really memorable to me in the early days, I touched on that first podcast about in 73, I think it was, when the ACHA World Hunt come to town. And, of course, my brother... Boy, he just had to know what was going on in the world. You know, when it comes to competition hounds, he had the fever pretty bad at that point. And during that hunt, and to explain for some of the younger guys that don't know, the ACHA World Hunt started on Monday night. And we're talking 3-hour casts again. Now, did you just think about this a little bit? We didn't have the nutrition for our hounds in them days that we do now.
Right.
You know, and... It started on Monday night, and it would be so many dogs that they couldn't get them all in the woods on Monday night. So the odds and the evens would split up on Monday and Tuesday night. And I think they hunted the evens on Monday night. So if your entry number was an even number, then you would hunt the first night. If your entry number was the odd number, you would hunt the second night. That got you through Monday and Tuesday. Then Wednesday, your cast winners off of Monday and Tuesday drew out on Wednesday. And of course, and back in them days, there wasn't to double rounds, there wasn't to loser's bracket. I mean, you had to win that cast to keep advancing, you know. But my brother snuck around and got figured out. There was two known dogs on that cast that night, and he got figured out who was guiding it and slipped over there. And he asked Daryl, he said, "Where are you taking them dogs?" And so we got up there in the country and got back in off the road in a farm, little farm field lane or something where we could hear that cast go on. And this is pretty memorable to me to look back. I didn't know at that point at 13 years old what I was seeing and hearing, you know, and that's it. If you're a houndsman before the days of Garmin's and everything, you heard it, but it played out in your mind what was going on, you know? Mm-hmm. So, and that's where I said in the first podcast about my granddad sat at the car and walk you through when that dog changed its mouth. Now hear that right there. He's working that riverbank. Hear him? Hear his voice echoing across the water, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Hear him right there. Hear him change up, get gruff. That's when he's getting in that tough stuff down there on the creek. Hear it, you know? And he'd sit there and he'd explain that stuff so that you could play it in your mind. Nowadays, you see it on a Garmin, you know? So you get to see all that stuff just like playing a video game on the couch. But back in those days, but we sat up there in the cast that night in the country, and they was just starting to cut timber pretty bad up here, and never ever did they clear cut it like they are now. You know, back in them days, everybody, they select cut. But it was cut pretty hard in there, and it's up here right north of where I live now. And I remember we're sitting there, and my brother, he's we always called him Whitey. Whitey said, "Oh man, them dogs is putting that track in that cutover back there on Willa." And about that time, they hit that cutover, and three dogs just bogged down and went to working. And there was one dog that took that stretch of cutover and went out the other side like he didn't even know it was there, and blew out on a little tree line off that cutover, and got up almost the end of that tree line and put enough heat on that coon that he clung. And I remember my brother the next day hunted Daryl up, asked him, said, "What dog was that took that cutover through that dart and went up on that finger and got treed like that and took that track away from them other dogs?" And I remember him saying that was Johnson's Banjo. So, and to go with that story then, and talking about pedigrees and dogs that was instrumental in that was the neighbor that I grew up next to up there always raised walker dogs in later years. Now in the early days he had great dogs like everybody else. I remember him hunting a little black and tan female, a little Kate female. It was a really nice little hound. Before he got into the purebreds then and was stayed with the walker breed, whatever the, and he always kept good females, and whatever was the hot ticket at that time for the walker breed, he would go breed to that stud dog. He would travel those miles, he'd get in that old truck and an old square bodied Chevy, and he would head off through the country and he would go breed to that stud dog and raise a litter of pups out of them. And then he would market those pups, you know, and a lot of people bought a lot of nice hounds off of him over the years as a baby, because he would breed to the top dog. And I mean, he bred to Godwin's Jolly and Johnson's Banjo. And he kept a female out of that litter he raised off of Johnson's Banjo. And way up when she was 12 or 13, he raised the last litter out of her. And she passed away trying to have that litter of pups. And his daughter took one male pup and bottle fed that puppy and got it raised up. And then that was his last good hound. And way up into the 80s, you know, we're talking about way up into the 80s, maybe even the early 90s, Harold had that dog that was a grand pup of Johnson's Banjo. And the thing I remember about him as much as anything was, they called him Bow Wow, was that dog's ability to tree laid up coon. And then when you got to doing a little research on Johnson's Banjo, he was one of those that could drive a track or he could tree a layup, either one, you know. Mm-hmm. And on the nights that the coon was laid up, there wasn't no tracks on the ground, he could pick one out of the wind and tree it. And that Bow Wow dog. I just night after night on cold winter nights, you know, he could tree a layup. And I said, and we'd kind of lost it in our modern hounds.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm seeing it come back some more. Yes. And I'm glad to see that, because that's something that the breeders hadn't been trying to keep up on. And that's where I have, at my kennel, have tried to stay a little bit with dogs that can tree a cold track and move it well and tree it, or that can tree a layup, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so there were, you know, the Johnson's Banjo thing, but then what comes to mind also, guys, is some of the females that was instrumental in the breed.
Mm-hmm. Dan, if you would, yeah. Let's take us, we're about 40 break. Minutes in, let's take a quick break.
Outlaw Light Company, owned by Alan Roberts, located in 10 Mile, Tennessee. 25 years of light building experience with the newest addition to their lineup, the Ace Pro. They are constantly striving for the best parts. The Ace Pro has better switches and batteries, and it has the option of double walk light and two additional color modules, main beam and a green laser, or a single walk light with three color modules, main beam and a green laser. All their lights are known for dependability and extreme brightness. Contact Outlaw Lights for their complete light selection. Their direct business number is 423-453-8813. The Ace Pro, the light with a lifetime warranty.
Briar Creek Kennels, feed and hunting supply store, owned by Chris Girth, located in Hemera, Indiana. Briar Creek carries all your pet supplies and is the headquarters for all your hunting dog gear. Never get caught in the dark. They carry Outlaw Lights, Superior Lights, and their own Briar Creek Light brand. They are an authorized Garmin and Dogtra dealer. They offer hunting apparel by Yoder Nylon, Southside Hunting Gear, Dan's, Razor, and their own Briar Creek branded gear. Dog boxes include Old Dry Pond and Diamond Deluxe, AGM thermals, engraved nameplates, dog collars, and leads are just a few of the many other offerings you can get from Briar Creek. Visit the store in person or shop online at www.shopbriarcreek.com. Or check them out at the major events. Their direct business number is 812-383-9489. Briar Creek Kennels Feed and Hunting Supply Store.
Dakota Lot Company, owned by Hoop and Tater Franklin, located in Tellico Plains, Tennessee. With the newest addition to their lineup, the Dakota Express. This light features the industry-leading True Dual Battery Pack cap light. Switching from battery 1 to battery 2 is a simple flip of a switch. Contact Dakota Lights for their complete light selection. All of their lights are known for dependability and extreme battery life. Their direct business number is 423-261-2551. Dakota Lights, great lights, and even greater customer service.
Coon Hunting Media is proudly sponsored by Little T Squatters. Them are the words every competition hunter loves to hear. Your winning coon has just been found. Little T Squatters, owned and designed by Tim Tempton, has set the bar for high quality, dependable, and unmatched performance. From pleasure hunters to extreme competitors, He covers it all with his five elite models. Original Little T, the Triple Threat, the Double Shot, the Pro Series, and the newly designed Bell Ringer. If you want to enter the woods with confidence, contact his office at 423-562-5333 and become elite.
In addition to our official sponsors, we would also like to thank the following sponsors. Secret City Kennels. The kennel is owned by Mr. Mark Gettner and Mr. Wendell Jones. At Secret City Kennels, they support the English Coonhound breed. They have English Coonhounds for sale from time to time. Contact Mark or Wendell for all your English needs. They are available for your English Coonhound advice and are happy to answer your questions. These guys have done their fair share of winning in the comp events, including wins at the PKC Labor Day Classic, fifth place overall in the UKC World Hunt, ninth place in the AKC World Hunt, English Days, Winter Classics, and the list goes on and on. Mark is the current PKC English Coonhound President. Give either of these guys a call. They will be glad to talk with you. Their numbers are Mark at 931-787-2784 or Wendell at 865-748-7795. They are located in Kingston, Tennessee and Coalfield, Tennessee.
Saddle Up Canine Cryo is owned by Mr. Bill Scheninger. Bill is located in Delta, Ohio. Don't miss out on the opportunity to keep that special stud dog forever. His services include semen collection, freezing, side-by-side shipping, and semen storage. Bill is also the owner of one of the best-known plot kennels in the country, Saddle Up Plots. Saddle Up Plots is home to UKC, PKC, AKC, WTDA, Grand Knight Champion, PR Saddle Up Lazarus. Lazarus accomplished the following accolades in 2021. He was UKC World Champ Plot, Plot Days Isaiah Kid Winner, Purina Breed Winner, Autumn Oaks Breed Champion, APA Breed Days Winner. Fresh chilled and frozen semen is available. Contact Bill directly for all pricing and services information for Canine Cryo and Saddle Up Plots. Bill's phone number is 419-467-7689. Saddle Up Plots, making plots rise again.
Welcome back, everybody, and we're going to let Dan get back into he's give us a bunch of insight on what these hunts were like and stuff when he was young and they first started, and he's kind of getting into the dogs now. So, Dan, what you start reminiscing and be thinking in your mind about some of the dogs. As we took the break, you was talking about the females, and then just start telling us about some of these dogs that you've hunted with over the years, and whether you hunted them or hunted against them or guided them.
Guided them. A lot of the bigger hunts would always come to this area, guys, and we would have Flora, Hit Robinson around, and Robinson would always take casts. And I remember Dwight and I was guiding and judging for the ATHA World there one year. I don't remember where it was at, but I'd always wanted to see the dog go, and I never got to see him go. You know, Russ Beller up there had always had some good dogs. He had Crossroads Killer and Pac-Man, and, you know, but the Striker dog, everybody always talked about how he could push a trap. And you just push a track, and we drew him on the night alone, my brother and I, to guide and judge him. And Ted Ramey from up there in, I believe, Northern Indiana, Southern Michigan, was handling him for Russell. And man, we was going through woods, you know, he was following us, and we was talking about, man, we get to see this dog go. And we got him out there. And I don't know if it was down to 2 hours yet or if it was still 3 hours. And we had him out there, and the poor dog was, and I was anxious to see him, and he wasn't even hunting good. He wasn't, you didn't have to run a time on him because he was staying out of the light. But he was just, you kept hearing him check back through close to you and everything. And I think he finally made a tree, but he was just, and Ted said, he said, man, he is off his game. He said, I don't know. He said something, he's not feeling good. And Ted said, is there a store open around here anywhere? And my brother said, man, I don't know. He said, what do you need? And he said, I need a dozen of eggs. And my brother said, well, I got eggs up at the house. And we was in that big river bottom right below where my brother lived. We was on the other side of it. We had to get in the truck. So we called time out. We got in the truck and we drove around to the other side and come in there to my brother's house. And he just, all the kids and his wife was in bed asleep. And he just went out to the chicken house. And he said, them kids may not have gathered eggs. Let me go see how many's out in the chicken house. And went out to the chicken house and come back with about a half a dozen or so. And anyhow, that boy broke them eggs and fed them to that dog raw. Mm-hmm. Walked him around there about 30 minutes. And you could just see he got to feeling better and got to acting better. And we went on down there another ways and went into that same great big bottom. Well, we hadn't even covered much of it, you know. And I'd always heard that dog could run a track with his head right straight out in front of him, you know. Mm-hmm. And we come down in there, and we was on the edge of a big hay field as it run off into bottom off the bluff. And he struck a track in one woods, and it broke out of that woods, and he started out across that open. And, man, he was moving that track good. And I looked at him. I said, would it hurt if I shine my light on him? Of course, it's old wheat lights back in those days, you know. He said, no, you ain't gonna bother that dog. And I shined my light on him as he went out through that hay field, right up that hill, right across there above us. And sure enough, I mean, that dog was pushing that track, and that head was right straight out in front of him. Looked like a beagle running a rabbit by sight, you know.
So you got to see
and it. He was driving that track, and he did not have that nose on the ground to do it. And there is probably, and that would have been, gosh, I don't know. I don't know where it laid in there with to put a time frame on that, but that would have been probably in the 80s there somewhere. Maybe up into the late 80s, early 90s, but there's, and then I got to dreaming and thinking about, man, these dogs that can, because I grew up in that era where they would, them old hounds, some of them would, guys, I'm talking about walk along and push a leaf over and snuff under it, and take two steps and push another leaf over and snuff under it, boo, you know, and they were just slow and monotonous, you know, and now all of a sudden, as a young kid there, I'm getting into the time frame that these, and where I'm talking about is the evolution of these dogs when they really started picking up and getting their head up and moving faster, you know. Mm-hmm. And you got to seeing it, and then right along in that same time frame is when they switched back to the 2 hour cast over the 3 hour cast, you know. And so that's been the evolution of that dog, but other memorable dogs that I remember being with, man, you know how many times I've slept since I've been on talking about them kind of cats, you know. Dak starts losing stuff after he sleeps too much. But you know, there was a lot of memorable dogs and up into the 90s and the 2000s, in the early 90s there, I was still hunting Vaughn bred dogs at that point. And I remember trying to look inside my breed and see something that would help me. And I kept hearing about these jet bred dogs. And I was still kind of a little country homeboy. And I think I touched on it in the first podcast when I met Ron Taylor and he had Levi and one of the first grands off of Levi at a RQE over here west of me over it was at St. Elmo's where the club was now. They got a club at Brownstown now, that club does, but you know, and seeing that 10-11 month old puppy that was already a night champion with a win or two towards grand, put on a show that night. Now, I beat him with a season 7-year old Grand Knight champion dog and at RQE that night. But I wasn't asleep to what that 10-month old puppy was doing out there. You know, when you're talking about a puppy pull up 50, 75 yards from him, other dogs and get split and never look back, that impressed me, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Because we was just starting to get into the era of the dogs that were independent, you know. And now we've got them independent to a fault when they hit the ground behind mama. A lot of it's still man-made, but more and more we're finding in every breed that real independent hound that we need to compete with to keep from, you know, everybody else. Or have a dog that's just shirt tail and everything, you know.
Right.
So, that I think about that in our breed, you know, but I never ever quit watching them Smoky River hounds and them Utchman bred hounds coming in out of the Southwest that come into this country, and I'd get to see them. And I never got to hunt with old Smoky River Diamond Jim. And within the blue tick breed, he caught a lot of flack because he was so light collared, you know, and everybody, there's always them naysayers, you know, oh, he's probably half Walker dog as light as he is or whatever. Mm-hmm. But we see them old genes pop up in our bloodlines modern day, you know, them old genes pop up every once in a while.
Oh, yeah,
and you know, and into this country down here, oh, Vandalia or Greenville down in there somewhere west of us down Interstate 70, there was a Grand Knight champion dog in that country that come up here and hunted up here for something one time, and it might have been the Blue Tick Grand National Reunion when we held it at Robinson. I know that was the year that Gentleman Jim won the Purina race, was that year, whatever year that would have been, but there was a dog that was real impressive that I got to see by the name of Schmitz Billy Jack, and he was directly, I believe, don't quote me because I may be wrong there, he may be in a grandson, but I do believe he was directly off of Smoky River Blue Diamond Jim. And that was a really impressive blue dog that moved around good, you know, and was a true Grand Knight champion. It wasn't, you didn't have to wonder how he got there, you know, when I got to see him go on that cast that time. But in the other breeds, some of the places I'd been and drew dogs, as we moved up into the more modern era, I had a real memorable cast one year at LaGrange, Indiana on Blue Tick Days. I got the privilege to draw Tree Slam and Blue Hillbilly.
Did you get to draw out with Hillbilly in some of them?
Yeah, and I got to draw, and on that same cast was Alan Holding, the black and tan male dog that he campaigned and advertised there for a while. Dang, the name of that dog is escaped me. I'm drawing a blank on that, but that was a real memorable cast, and that thing was the dog I was hunting, and those two dogs, that cast was anybody's game right down until the buzzer went off. It was anybody's game. It was a real close cast, and I remember how I won that cast. Mine never even hesitated at the water on the last track of the night, and they was running together. Mine never even hesitated. And in the last 30 seconds of the cast, mine got treed in the swamp. And I had to wait out there in chest deep water to get him off that tree. But we could score from the bank of the swamp. We could look out in there and see his coon. He was up on the side of a little willow tree out in that swamp. And I had to wait out there in chest deep water to get him. But there was two nice hounds there that night. And like I said, I won the cast. But man, that was anybody's game right up to the last minute. You know,
mm-hmm.
and in 1976, we took English Days here at Robinson, and we held it right here at Oblong at the fairgrounds. And some English dogs that really impressed me. And I wish I could remember that little female's name, because now in 76, I do believe that would have still been 3-hour cast, but there was a little female come into this country out of Kansas that was in that cast that night. And in that 3-hour cast, she treated 13 coon just about as handy as you'd ever want to see it done. Now I'm telling you, she was a nice one.
13.
She was a little red English female.
That's a good number of coons to tree in a week around here.
Yeah. And after you all been up here, you know how it can be done here because we've got a lot of. Now we did not have near the coon in the 70s. We do here now. You know, there's nobody that takes coon anymore except us few houndsmen that. In kill season, knock some out to young dogs were starting or something, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, there was a slew of trappers and hunters coming up through the 60s and 70s, you know, $20, $30 coon, and everybody was trying to supplement their income with some fur money. And some more memorable English dogs that year, he was up early and was looking for somebody to guide him. And at 70, in 76, I'd have been 16 years old, just had my own license, you know, my driver's license, but I had my own truck, my own dog box. And I was in at the fairground, you know, it was my home club and getting ready to hold English days there in 1976. But Ed Bates was there. And everybody knew Ed Bates from Hard Time Spec. And then his younger dog he had coming up that he had with him was Hard Time Gun. And I didn't get to see him go in the cast, but I got to get to see him go pleasure hunting. And them were some really nice hounds, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And English breed. Larry Wilcox, talking in English breed. I was with Larry Wilcox two or three times. I don't remember which hounds it was, but was always impressed with his hounds. You know, he was always following the good one. We all know right across the river here was Jim Ridge. Jim always had some good English dogs.
And so you're getting into a lot of the names that I remember were the top English dogs when we were teenage boys. You know, like what were some of Larry's? That Thunder St. Nick and what were some of the other names of some of those dogs he had that were so popular?
Yeah. St. Nick, I think, was the blue English dog, I believe, if I remember right. But he had a couple of nice red ones.
Yeah, I remember all his full-page ads in the bloodlines and stuff.
The first dog I remember, Jim Ed, crossing the river and coming over here and campaigning back there probably in the 70s, maybe early 80s, was old Briar Creek Chopper. And he showed Boyd's Little Joe on his third generation. And that's one thing about Boyd's Little Joe, you know. And I think Boyd's Little Joe's pedigree might have showed Rock and Nell. As his parents, you know, he was a single registered dog. But one thing about Boyd's Little Joe, even two or three generations coming down off of him, 90% of the pups that he put on the ground had some drive. I mean, they would go get gone,
mm-hmm.
you know, but by that time we were starting to get the first of the tracking systems, you know, where you keep better track of your dogs and everything. But that was one thing in the English breed, you know, Boyd's Little Joe always put that hard going, hard drive, cover ground quick, get treed quick in them. And in the late 70s into the early 80s, when I got my first good blue female, fella up here hunting at that point, working, and I got to hunting with him and he moved. I found him a rent house so he could get closer up here to me because I had better hunting than what he was finding down there around Olney. He was working out of Olney at an oil company down there. And Frank Watts was his name, old Butch Watts. And he was a lot of what made me understand the rules and stuff better. We'd be between dumps pleasure hunting and he'd go over them rules with me and he would, now what would you do in this situation? How would you score that situation? You know, but Butch had been in the top 20 of the ACHA world twice. He in 80 at DuQuoin, Illinois, and in 81 at Pine Bluff, Arkansas. He'd got Roger King's Peggy dog in the top 20 of that ACHA world hunt 2 years in a row. And old Peggy died on him on the way home with a twisted stomach coming back from Pine Bluff. But he was hunting dogs off of her. And that's how, and he explained to me as much as anything about Boyd's Little Joe, you know, mm-hmm. and and where that drive come from, and then from the dogs he had, they had brought Peggy up after she'd placed in the top 20 the first time, brought her up and bred her to Emory Stroll's Nick dog over here at Newton. And Frank was hunting, or old Butch was hunting dogs off of that cross. And Emory Stroll's Nick dog, which I had owned as a kid, I had owned Nick's mother. And she showed Merchant's Banjo on her three generation pedigree.
Everybody knows that Merchant's
Banjo was a walker dog, mm-hmm. you know. But there you go back to the yellow papers.
Yep.
You know, she had yellow papers. But now she could tree lay up coons. And after Dad had bought her for me, then they come back later trying to get their hands back on her because they'd raised a litter of pups off of her. And it was the, you know, and it was that cross down there that Butch was hunting dogs off of old Nick and them. Well, no, it was the cross that Nick was out of was what they had her wanting to come back in, because he could tree layups like no other, mm-hmm. you know, and they wanted to come back on that. But you know, I started to touch on females a while ago, guys. Within every breed, you grew up in a plot household, so you can think of probably a plot female or two in the breed. I can think of one in a blue tick breed, Sebastian's Penny. They said you could have bred her to a fence post and she'd throw tree dogs, mm-hmm. you know. Kentucky Jude, you know. They said you could have bred her to a fence post and she'd throw tree dogs.
Mm-hmm.
And talking about Kentucky Jude and Joe House and some of them house bred dogs, you know. Lipper was known for the voice that he put on them dogs, mm-hmm. you know. And the Vaughn dogs that I started with, I think it probably come through the buck side the way I understood it, but man, some of them dogs had mouths on them. And Rip comes back with that now, and Snap. And when I started questioning about that, you all said that comes up through Crash down there, you know. So there were so many dogs that was instrumental in the breeding programs of people, you know. And Lipper for his voice. In 2000, I think it was, ACHA World was the guys was trying to rejuvenate ACHA and bring it back to the old week long world hunt in one place. And I went to Central City, Iowa to hunt in that. Hold a little old pop up camper up there, and it was getting down in the 20s at night. I remember I had an electric blanket. If I hadn't that electric blanket, I think I'd have froze, but I stayed all week up there and little plot female. I think she made the final four that year. She wasn't really little. She's a big leggy jip, had a white chest and some white toes. And everybody, I didn't get a hunt with her, but everybody's commenting on that mouth. And he was up there, I think, for the top 20 photos or something. And I was, because I was there all week on the grounds, you know, staying at the fairground. And I heard somebody say to him, "Where does that female get that great big mouth?" And he grinned kind of funny, that old gentleman. I don't remember his name. You'd have to go back somewhere in the archives and find that hunt and figure out even who owned her. It was an older gentleman. And he said, "Oh," he said, "son," he said, "old Lipper put a good mouth on them dogs for several generations." And henceforth came the extra white that was in there.
How many plot breeders did that back in the day? All breeds did it. I mean, that's funny.
Yes, you reached out, you know, and you can't tell me you can't tell me that they didn't reach out into the bird dog breeds and everything. And I really think that we could take our breed and say that that's what got their head up off the ground and got them to moving quicker, you know,
mm-hmm.
was probably some bird dog pushed in there. Now's the day of DNA. You can't lie about it. But yep. But back in the day, they could put some stuff in there to try to help the breed, you know. But I think all the cur dogs that the old gentleman had when I was at growing up. The little black and white cur dogs and the old ring neck red dogs, the old red dogs, the white ring neck and white chest. And you know, somebody down along the line had kept that alive because, boy, they just keep popping up every so often, you know?
Yeah.
And a lot of them good dogs. In the early days, the red bone breed, dad's dad, the coon hunter's coon hunter. There was one other coon hunter's coon hunter in this area, and he always hunted red dogs, and granddad always hunted blue dogs if he could find them. But Floyd, a lot of them good red dogs in the early days had quite a bit of white in their chest and maybe some white on their feet, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Was it Walker dog, or was they just not pure red at that point? You know, and I think we can all say that we have seen in our breeds, you know, when they get to breed and try to get that better collar and all that, you've seen some of the ability go away. Mm-hmm. So it's to sit here, and I just keep thinking of it. You guys, and you're not that much younger than me, but you cannot imagine the evolution that I've witnessed in my lifetime, you know, because when I started, me and Whitey, we'd show up at the woods, you know, and they'd pull up there to where you would always dump loose at, and there'd be a pile of carbide still smoldering, you know.
Yeah.
And you knew one of them old timers had been there ahead of you.
Mm-hmm. Had beat
you. I said, we're gonna go somewhere else. And Whitey said, no. He said, they've been out of here long enough. Them coon that's gonna move late will be down moving. Sure enough, we'd about always tree a coon in there behind them, you know.
That's pretty good.
But yeah. And you don't even think, I don't even think about that a lot of time. What made me think of that, I don't know. But we pulled down in there North Fork Bottom at night and pulled in there, and right there on the driver's side was where he'd emptied out his carbide light when he was done hunting for the night, you know? And I remember among us, my brothers and guys that would come go hunting with us and stuff, a lot of people still used a carbide light back in them days.
Mm-hmm.
And I still wonder, you know, why a coon won't look at a red lens or an amber lens like they would them old carbide lights, you know? And I think it was wheat light for a while, put that flicker in their light, you know, trying to get that flicker come back because everybody was complaining that the coon wouldn't look at a real light like they would a carbide light, you know, that flame flickering on that mm-hmm. reflector.
You don't know so, how many conversations we've had about reviving the flicker light. we all yeah. love the flicker
yeah.
light. But
yeah,
hey, let's do this, Dan. We're about out of time. Of course, and it's unfair, but we're a bunch of blue tick guys, so we have the right to, and it's our podcast, so we have the right to decide. Let's talk a minute and kind of finish it off. But think of let's just say from the 1990s on, so we're still getting back in time, but up to yeah. present. What would be maybe just a few blue ticks that just really stood out that you've either handled or hunted against or whatever, that you know those are still dogs that are going to be very prevalent in pedigrees today, because I mean I in my mind I could done a few of the dogs that are in my dog's pedigrees and the stuff we hunt. You've hunted with a lot of them dogs, so you knew how they operated. Yeah. So what's just a couple of maybe a standout blue tick or two that you've seen go.
I touched on it, Jason, in the first podcast. My first wife had a massive heart attack at 36 years old. And that was the year that I met Ron Taylor at the RQE. And I did not get to go to the UKC World that fall because she had that heart attack the week after Autumn Oaks, coming right up into that. And the zones were going to be up at Shell Rock. They were going to be in Iowa that year. And a dozen people, I suppose, told me after the fact, man, if I'd have known that you was not going to be able to take old Buster up there, I would have took him. I would have paid the way because I had my entry in and everything, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And she was, and all I could do at that point was try to be there with my wife and try to keep her alive down at Evansville, Indiana, at the hospital. And but he got sick and went down on me, and I lost him. And by the time it was where I could get, my wife was getting good enough, you know, and they had her stabilized and I could get back in the woods some, I was without a good dog, a good broke dog. Mm-hmm. And I called Ron Taylor, and he was winning a bunch with Levi at that point, you know, I called Ron and I told him my situation. I asked him if he needed any help with some dogs. And I think I touched it on the first podcast. It was right around 5 years that I spent hunting dogs for Ron, and he always paid my way to the major events and kept me involved in it. And I've always been grateful for that. But probably, some of the more memorable dogs, because he had some good ones. We all know that, you know, many guys that can say that you won the Autumn Oaks and Winter Classic in the same year with the same dog, you know, mm-hmm. That was Levi. Bingo. Very, very memorable dog. The thing that was more impressive to me about Bingo, as much as his ability to tree a coon at night, was his the dual dog. He came to Robinson to the Blue Tick, the fall BBCHA Blue Tick sectional that we have, or no, it had been spring. It was always the spring hunt was the sectional. He come. Stacked that dog on the bench, come early that day, stacked that dog on the bench and walked off and started visiting with people while the judge walked up and down looking at them dogs, you know, and there he stood solid as a rock, but was an exceptional hound. And Ron, I've heard and been in Ron's hearing several times when he would say that dog was the steadiest dog of consistency night after night. And we all know that's what it takes to win a world hunt, or is that consistent night after night, not a one night wonder, but a dog that is there every night, you know. Mm-hmm. and that was impressive to me. Had a good mouth, probably a better mouth than his daddy did, you know. Levi had a beautiful mouth, but it did not, as he got some age on him, especially he was getting some age on him when I started being around him some, it did not carry as good as we'd like it to, you know. Had more of that coarse, gravelly, blue tick type mouth. Bingo's carried good. Then came along Dancer, you know, and everybody knows he made the final four, was knocking on the door, caught a bad break that night, or probably would have been our first UKC world champion blue tick. Mm-hmm. But I think he was about 10 months old the first night I went with him. And I went over there and hunted with Ron that night. And the thing that always impressed me about Dancer, he just didn't have many off nights where he wasn't feeling good or something. Everything that Dancer done was Mach 4 plus with his hair on fire. I mean, he was in our breed. That was the first real hard going explosive of that caliber. You know, and a lot of people seen him later in life after Ron had changed his tree and style, said, well, he wasn't no kind of tree dog. Well, no, if other dogs was on that tree, he was down off that tree, treeing on all four, you know, mm-hmm. which is not real impressive, but it was man-made. I saw him when he didn't do that, you know, mm-hmm. and other dogs within the breed, man. That was the dog, either pup or grand pup off of Smoky River Diamond Gym. He was impressive. Schmitz Billy, Granite Champion Schmitz Billy Jack. That was an impressive dog. He was just, he wasn't explosive per se, but man, he was just steady. You know, he was, I really liked the way he worked and everything. The newer dogs now, I mean, Johnny and Kyle's following a good one. Mm-hmm. He's, you know, what I've seen of his sister, I really like that. You've got a pretty nice one out here I'm fooling with. Mm-hmm. I just, you know, but it all goes back. And when you get to chasing it, it all goes back to them. We've been talking about it. Ties mm-hmm. back in there. Mark Van Vetter, you know, Leroy's a good one.
Yeah, actually,
Satan was a good one. You know,
you're talking about some of those. I think there's some very common attributes about those dogs. I mean, that's like I think Crash is going to really prove out to be a top stud dog. I mean, I was talking to a boy today. So you've got you've got to see Snap going. I was talking to a boy down in Louisiana today that's got a litter mate brother. He's a grand knight already. He just qualified him for the world. And the conversation we had, actually, we're working a podcast up to talk about another historical line of blue ticks. And he said that was the most consistent coon treer. I even told the boys that I talked to him for a while, but he said that was one of the most consistent coon treeing machines he's ever walked behind. So it's,
yeah,
you see it out of so many different females off of this one stud dog, or like you said, so many different ones out of a certain female every single tree. So there's going to be some that's really making some impacts on that.
And our breed today, and I don't know if I touched on the first podcast that I've done with Kyle, but in our breed today, I mean, until you guys done that podcast with Mark about, you know, his line of dogs and everything, without that podcast, I would have never stopped and thought about the fact how implemental he has been in our breed now, with him taking her and breeding her to all them different stud dogs, all them known stud dogs. You know, he didn't just keep going back to the same old stump. He reached it out there, and now we have the ability to go back and line breed off of that from different angles. And Mark might have had the foresight to know what he was doing, but I don't think he probably really did, guys.
Mm-hmm.
But it's one of them things that has worked out in our favor, you know, because right there is a pretty good foundation to start off of, and now you can shoot at it from different angles.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah. He actually sent me a video today of some puppies. He's got a puppy that I raised. I bred one of my females, Cody and Evans, and I did, and to Leroy. And he sent me a video today, and he said, that's your puppy up on the table tree in the house, Cat. And the other puppy was out of Leroy and a crash female. It was actually a litter mate sister to Rip. So those crosses are, you know, that's different females bred to Leroy right now. And both of them, they were sitting there, and he said, I can't hardly even turn them loose. He said, because they just terrorize my house cat all the time. And it was up in the loft of the loft of his garage. So, there's going to be a lot of there's some good ones out there to choose from. So, We probably need to call this one close up to an end. We're already, believe it or not, we're already an hour and 10 minutes in. So
time we put commercial.
No, like we'll do it as much as you want.
Too much, my coffee's gone cold.
That's why you should have brought a thermos down like I did.
Yeah, Jason.
Yeah, but with me babbling, I didn't have time to pour another cup.
I didn't have time to go brew another pot and refill the thermos.
But guys, I appreciate it. You know, I feel so blessed to be able to have done the things I've done, and we didn't even get into these modern dogs that I've been guiding and over the last couple 3 years since pro sport's been coming to town and all that. And you know, man, there's been some impressive hounds out there. Couldn't name them all, but you know, it's just a blessing to be here. I appreciate you guys, what you're doing. And like I told Kyle in the first podcast, I appreciate that there's something for the younger generation to listen to. Maybe they can pick up some good out of it, you know? And
well, I've actually learned quite a bit with your first part of this podcast tonight, just back to some of those old pedigrees and stuff. So that's been interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. And I wish I knew pedigrees better. But when I first got into blue ticks, you know, and fawn dogs, and like I said in the first podcast, I went to trying to chase that back, and I found Oscar Thomas. And, man, he was a pedigree guru, especially when it come to the fawn dogs. And he, you know, and I really learned to appreciate and watch those pedigrees. And then you can learn a lot by what's going on around you, too, by looking at people's pedigrees. You know, all of a sudden, 1984, a red bone makes the final four of the UKC World Hunt, you know, and Hunter's Famous Amos. And all of a sudden you look and look at his pedigree. What do you see show up two or three times in that third generation pedigree? Hunter's Famous Amos Hunter's Famous Amos was the one that made the final four. It was, what was that dog? You'd have to pull out that pedigree and look. But he had the same stud dog in his three generation pedigree like three different times.
Three different times, yeah. And that's That's the kind of stuff that I like to hear about some of these old dogs, because they're in those pedigrees. So and we go back and we can find them and see what they're about.
Yeah. Yes. And so if you can look at pedigrees, look at people's advertisements. You know, look at their stud dog advertisements in the Blue Book or the English Breeders Yearbook or whoever. Get to looking at them pedigrees. Get to looking at that line breeding they've done, and you know, and you can see what different breeders is trying to do to better their breed that way. But I hope that somebody can find some good out of what I babbled about tonight. I sure appreciate it, guys. And
we appreciate you sitting down and taking some time for us tonight.
Yeah, and it was a night I decided I wasn't going to get in the woods anyway. I didn't want to tear up a dog's feet because I wanted him to be there for tomorrow night. So, yeah. And you learn from experience. Like I was saying about that night, I could not believe how bad them dog's feet got in an hour and a half on that frozen snow that night. So, but anyway, guys, you have a good evening down there in Tennessee. Thanks again for everything.
All right, and, buddy. Well, we appreciate you. Appreciate you a bunch. You have a good night, Dan.
Okay, you too.